Sāvaka Angelica Radio, Anusaram Punyaketa Lokasa, Tamahang Sangam Abhipujayami, Tamahang Sangam Sirasanamam.
This is what should be done, but one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, three questions. Anyway, I did promise I'd answer this one quickly.
Can you please give advice for eating meditation? Do I focus on mind or body? For eating meditation, it's not just using mindfulness, but kindness as well. What are you eating for? Make sure you don't eat too much, not too little, just the right amount. And it's nice that we're not speaking when we eat, so we can put all our awareness on our eating. And one of the things to do there is that when you are eating, you pick up a spoon of food or a chopstick worth of food or whatever. There's always, you see, people with a morsel of food in front of them, and they've already got a morsel in their mouth chewing. So you've got one in the mouth, one on the spoon, one in the plate, which you've already got next, and you're thinking about the third or fourth morsel in front of you. So the point is, don't be too far ahead of yourself when you're eating. One morsel at a time. So you put it in your mouth, and you don't think what you're going to eat next. You eat what's in your mouth, first of all. So you chew it, and if you enjoy it, all of the digestive juices come out of your body. If you're not paying attention to what you're eating, of course, not so many delicious flavors are recorded, which means you don't emit so much saliva and other stuff, which means you don't have a good digestion. And it's just one of the reasons, because I pay so much attention when I'm eating, it means that my digestion is so good that out of just, you know, even one spoonful of food, so much of it just gets absorbed into my body, which is why I put on weight. I don't eat that much, but I digest so beautifully that it all sort of comes inside. That's one of my other excuses. I've got many more. Hi, Ajahn, can we have Mu give a guided meditation again, please? That's two you've already done. Oh, she's gone. Where is she? She's hiding. What have you done to her? Okay. Sorry? You're good. Okay. Very good. The morning talk was really inspirational. It was like an answer for my questions about the meaning of life. It put things in perspective. The 10-minute guided meditation was so powerful. I read before, and I have faith of rebirth, but the visualization meditation, like hitting to the core, and gave a tingling sensation from my head to my toe. I even cried imagining my own rebirth and redeath. This really set up my today's meditation. Thank you. Another satisfied customer. But where that came from, just, it's a little bit, for many people, imagining they were the Buddha is, you know, a little bit sort of, or even blasphemous, if you like that word, you know, that you're not supposed to sort of imagine you're the Buddha. The Buddha is too holy. But it was very useful. It came from the time when I went to Singapore to the Little Gems group, and they was close to Waysack, and they said, can you teach these little kids something about Waysack? And these were like kindergarten, four-year-olds, five-year-olds. And so you can't teach them the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the intricacies, the right translations for samadhi. It's not concentration, kids, it's stillness. So you can't teach them dependent origination, that's for sure. So I thought, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? So I thought it was Waysack. So the first thing, that the birth of the Buddha. So I said, imagine. Okay, kids, imagine that you're the Buddha just been born. So you take seven steps and you put your finger up. That finger, not the middle one. Say, I am the chief. This is my last birth. And they all did that. They imagined doing that. So slowly, because, you know, the Buddha, you know, he's not just runs around very slowly. Oh, this is my last life. And they all did that. And so I thought that wasted about 5 minutes, and I've got another hour or so to go. So there, the Buddha's enlightenment. And then I said, okay, now, you see the big Buddha statue over there? So sit down on the ground and just cross your legs, put your right hand over your left hand, thumbs touching back straight, and head down. Now imagine you're the Buddha, just enlightened under the Bodhi tree. And of course, I was doing it with them. This was really neat. This is really good. But play acting, you feel it, oh yeah. And the kids actually just got into it too. Children have great imaginations. Everything done, nothing more to do, just still, peaceful, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And they were really into it. And I didn't really, I opened my eyes to sort of ring the bell, and the teacher said, no. Because the teachers were enjoying the stillness too. But we had to come out and said, okay, the last one, the enlightenment, the final passing away of the Buddha. So on your right side, you know, and they'd all got on their right side, and put your hand under your head, and then left foot over the right foot, and then you're the Buddha passing away. Nothing more to be done. And they got into that too. And they were just really peaceful. And they said, that was the quietest Waysak demonstration to children ever in that little kindergarten. But also they had an idea of what it all meant. And afterwards I taught it to the adults, and they liked it too. And I used it for myself. Because what it does, the play acting, the role playing, you actually almost become that part. You feel what it's like to be fully enlightened. You've got a taste of freedom. No more striving. No more wanting, no more figuring anything out. You're done with that. You don't have to think anymore. You don't have to plan. You're enlightened, for goodness sake. There's nothing else to do. You've reached a goal. You really are retired. And you actually feel it. And it really gets into you. And you get a taste of what peace is. And the end of striving. Anyway. I like doing that, and if it works, why not? Dear Ajahn, is will the house builder? Oh yeah, it is. Sankara is the house builder. You have built, this is the old saying in the suttas, that house builder, you will build no more rebirths for me. Your rafters have been taken down. Your bricks have been removed. Tiled roof, it doesn't actually say that, but that's why they have houses these days. It's been demolished. No more houses will be rebuilt. And that's, what is the house builder? Your will. That's the word sankhara. And sometimes if you say sankhara, it's mental volition, it's fabrications, it's whatever, but what it really means is will. And that's, I said, well, it means will and a few other things. And Ajahn Brahmali he's great having a student who can teach their teacher. So he told me, he said, look, here. You've got a very good point there. So, instead of trying to just be what it means, will and a few other things, the core meaning of sankhara is will. Now that is powerful. Now the fourth of the khandhas, will. So that is the problem, not the solution. Next one. Can you tell a super scary ghost story, please? A super scary one. Okay, now what's this? I'll just leave this for a moment because I do this once first of all. I'll tell it at the very end. When you will have to go out. How to think more positive and control our emotions. How to think more positive is very good if you can. I'm not quite sure about the best blood group to have. No, be positive. Be positive, Ananda. So it might help to just go get a blood transfusion and get be positive put in there. It might kill, I don't know anything about medicine, so it might kill you, but... And control our emotion. If you try and control emotions, they can make them worse. So So just let them go. They're not mine. Nothing to do with me. Emotions, none of my business. And when I don't feed my emotions, the emotions, they wither and they die. So you don't feed them at all. So emotions, actually, there are, control our emotions, there are two types of emotions. The negative emotions and the positive emotions. The negative emotions is, yeah, I'm bored. I've heard all these stories before. I want real meditation. Why don't we meditate all night, tonight? Yeah, let's go for it. So we've got the negative emotions, which are fault-finding, aversion. Even like wanting is a negative emotion. You're wanting something else means you're not happy with what you've got. So those negative emotions, they get superseded by the positive emotions. Contentment. Isn't it wonderful you're actually here? Here in the Jhana Grove, one of the best meditation centers in the world. You're comfortable with an incredibly good cook. Just with really kind people. And just really cost effective. This is, you know, my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra. I always used to, whenever he used to do anything and he'd send me to build something, I said, what should I do? He said, get the cheapest and the best. And I think this retreat center qualifies for that. They're probably the cheapest retreat center in the world and the best. So it's very good value for money. So what more do you want? So you come here and say, well, I want to be enlightened. Oh, come on, you can't ask for everything. Well, who can get jhana? Oh, come off it. You know, you give you a nice place to sleep, good food, nice jokes, and you want to get good meditation as well? Who will you ever be satisfied? But this does become good meditation. So, control our emotions. You just leave them alone. Let them be. And then the best emotion is the emotion of kindness and peace. And the emotion of inspiration. The sort of emotion that I hope many of you felt just when you were just imagining you were the Buddha. That stillness is an emotion. It's a feeling. It's a sense of deep stillness. Contentment, peace, joy. It's the emotion of like prasadi, tranquility. And sukha and pity, the joy and the bliss, which is emotions. And control your emotions. You have to let your emotions fly in deep meditation, because your emotions get incredibly strong. Because you get bliss and joy and power, and if you try to control those emotions, you just really just tend to get very tight and tense, and you don't need to control them. Just give them their full rein, let them go, and you'll find those emotions are just so blissful. You don't try and stop them or steer them or do anything. Just the mind knows what to do, but just let the mind do its job. And get into those very, very deep, beautiful, peaceful meditations. So please don't control. As one person said, that they were, I'm always telling them to let go, especially when you go to the deep meditations. You're getting limiters, but you'd always tend to control them. And then she told me she had this dream. That she, in the dream, she was driving a car and I was in the passenger seat. And we were going, she lost control of the car, and we were going over a cliff. And she started to panic, because I was in the passenger seat. I said, take your hands off the steering wheel. Feet off the... Oh, we go over the cliff, we'll die! Hands off the steering wheel. Feet off the pedals. Let go! So she did. And we hurtled over the cliff! And the bottom of the cliff was a long way down. just flying through us to certain death at the bottom of the cliff. And when she was panicked, relax. To the max. We didn't say that then, but that works. Relax. To the max. Well, I'm going to die. Relax. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was just almost like a little curve. And the problem was, you know, the car took the curve according to her dream, and we leveled out, we didn't sort of crash or do any damage, but there's this really sharp right turn, like almost like a hairpin turn, and we were going too fast. So she reached for the steering wheel and the pedals, and I said, hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, let go. But she had to make a really quick right turn. Hands off the steering wheel. Relax to the max. And in her dream, what looked like certain death, the car just made its perfect right turn all by itself. And then we were just cruising safely down this road at the bottom of the cliff. No damage, no injury, perfectly okay. And she said she had that in her dream. I said, great, now do that in your meditation.
You couldn't.
But Lisa was a good dream that she told me about, that it was actually sort of working. So that's actually one of the reasons why, if we do this meditation properly, that in the, we do let go and it's totally safe. Which is the positive emotion of letting go. If you control, it usually messes up. Okay, dear Ajahn, if Gatikara could remember his friend Jyotipala, why didn't he remember the Dhamma before Buddha Gautama's Dhamma Chakrasutta? Exactly. Maybe the Siddhartha Gautama sitting under the Bodhi tree, in the first watch of the night, did the jhanas, did the jhanas, the first watch of the night, he remembered his previous births. That's what it said. And one of those previous births would have been under the Buddha Kassapa. He would have remembered a lot of those teachings which he learned under Kassapa. The second watch of the night, understood karma, just how these rebirths happened. And then the next watch of the night, discovered the Four Noble Truths. But did he discover himself? Or, as it says in some suttas, it was just an ancient path which had been grown over. And he just cleared that path to see the great citadel of Nibbana. So this was it a rediscovery or just a new discovery? Did he get help from his memory of the previous time under Kassapa the Buddha? So you make your ideas, but I say there's no way that a person can become enlightened without the seed from another person who's seen the Dhamma, at least an Aryan, someone who's at least a stream winner. So Siddhartha Gautama, that's where he got his paratagosa, the words of another. Some people disagree with that, but that's what I would put my money on if I had any money. So, why didn't he remember the Gatikara Sutta? So why do you remember the Dhammacakka Sutta? Of course, he didn't remember Dhammacakka Sutta as a teaching, but he would have remembered the teaching of a Buddha. Dear Ajahn, I saw a stack of hay and some cow dumps. Do we rear cows in the vicinity of Jhana Grove? No, the only person who goes moo here. is the MU. Now what happened there is a cow which escaped from Karnak Prison Farm. And, well, we checked because somebody saw this big cow around. It's around where the caravan park used to be. And so we rang around trying to find out where it came from. and found it was an escape crim from escape prisoner, anyway, prison cow from Cardiff. And so it was a bit emaciated, and it was very thirsty during the dry season, so he put some water and some hay out for it. So tame it a little bit so we could see what happened. But we don't rear cows. It's a sanctuary for cows, I suppose. It's, you know, where we can sort of keep them, especially old cows. It's like a kind of museum. Thank you, Brian, for the beautiful guided meditation this morning. I've had many ones in the past 50 years, and it's probably the best ever. Yeah. Ooh. Venerable Moo is a good speaker. Two thumbs up for her. Only two thumbs up. I like her. Thanks for giving us a chance to listen to her guidance. But when she provided guidance through meditation, can she speak louder? Other than all that, is good. Oh, always for finding. So, yeah, if you can speak louder, it's always good. Can I use earplugs during the guided meditation? No, what? That's why you can't hear her. That says, can I use earplugs during meditation? Yeah, but not the guided meditation. Regarding impermanence, the human body changes from the physics, for the physics of a baby to toddler to adolescent to adult to elderly and finally back to elderly adolescents to toddlers and to baby again. Finally decay off. Can we relate impermanence to these? Change, yes. You can say that is impermanent. Nothing ever is the same. But the big impermanence, that is the one where things vanish. Because everybody can know that, the changing nature of the body. And that's one of the reasons I like the cycle of existence. Because you begin life with nappies. You end your life wearing nappies. Incontinent. You start your life with no teeth, and if it wasn't for dentists, you'd end your life with no teeth, with dentures. You start your life with no hair, and you end your life bald, sometimes prematurely if you go forth. You start your life not being able to walk, and you end your life not being able to walk. You start your life, what else have we got? Sorry? Sight, yeah. When you can't really make out too much when you're born. And when you're old, you have to wear glasses. You start your life not being able to hear properly, and you end your life needing earplugs. And, no, not earplugs, what they call the hearing aids, yeah. And but there's one thing in your life. Get stronger and stronger the older you become. Your legs are weak, your arms are weak, everything is weak, but the one thing which gets stronger and stronger the older you get is your mouth. Oh, people can talk without stopping. They can't hear very much, but they can talk. So anyway, yeah, that's all impermanence, but it's the stuff which you don't expect. The stuff which just really sees the Dhamma in a totally different way. At the beginning, we could hear your introduction, but when you started the guided meditation, oh no, this is Dear Ayamu, your voice became so soft that I could only catch a few words here and there, so I could not follow. Hope you'll raise your voice a bit in the next session. Thank you. It wasn't that she was speaking too soft. You were listening. What? With your earplugs in. Okay, I think she's got the message. Did you use the microphone?
I did.
Yeah, okay. So what you can do is you can go in the back there and just raise the volume. It is said that one of the heavy good karmas, the wholesome counterpart of the heavy bad karmas like killing your parents and arahat, is getting into jhanas, the heavy good karmas. But you said in jhanas there is no more will intention. If karma is intention action, how is this possible? Can you please explain how it works? How you're trying to catch me out. The heavy good karmas, the wholesome counterpart of the heavy bad karmas, like killing your parents and arahat, I don't know where that is in the suttas. You do know that liberations of the mind is this really incredibly good karma. It just makes a huge impression on you, because I think it was Ajahn Kantipala a long time ago. I don't know where he got it from, if he invented it, wonderful little saying. What is good karma? No, kusala karma, meritorious karma. And he said in brief, it's the step closer to nibbana. And bad karma is a step in the opposite direction, going backwards away from nibbana. And I thought that was a brilliant sort of little description of what karma really is. And if it's going to lead you closer to nibbana, that is good karma. Certainly jhanas do. Sort of doing something evil or bad, or like bad karma, like just, just killing somebody or just stealing or something, then that is pushing you further away from nibbana. So, has jhana got any karmic effect when there's no will actually in the jhana? Yes, of course it is, because it is the will is being suppressed. Karma is intention. This is actually going way beyond the karma. The karma, which is even like a hosi, which is a ninja, which doesn't create any rebirth, because it's the wisdom, the letting go, which arises after karma, after sort of jhanas. That is what is liberating. But it's not just the karma which gives rise to this and that in your next life. It's this karma which is ending rebirth. It's not the karma which is associated with how you're going to be in a future existence. It's tending to stop these things. Anyway, in moments when we are peaceful, letting go in meditation, even though not in jhana, is karma created? It is in a sense, but it's the karma which stops karma. It is the karma of peace and stillness. You can call it karma if you want, but it's not active in a rebirth in the karma loka, if you know what that means. I'm not sure if I know what that means, but it sounds good. How does the process of escaping samsara happen if there is no will, no one, and nothing to improve? Exactly. When there is no will escaping samsara, that samsara just disappears. If you try to get rid of it, you make it stronger. That's why that the three cravings, the karma dhanha, that's the craving for the sensory experience, the five senses, bhava dhanha, the craving to exist, to keep on being, and vibhava dhanha, the craving to get rid of yourself. If you try to escape, you always get caught. You just go around in circles. That's not the way to escape from the prison. You can't jump over the walls. They're too high. Well, that reminds me of that story of great escapes. Moondyne Joe, who escaped from Fremantle Prison. I thought this was really cool. And he actually escaped. He was never found. Moondyne Joe. He was one of these bush rangers a long time ago. So he got put in Fremantle Jail. And there, you had to just do heavy labor. And so he had to literally break rocks. And he was very happy to break the rocks. He had a big sledgehammer, he'd break all these rocks. And got bigger and bigger muscles, really fit. But because You know, he's a dangerous criminal. Always had to have a guard in attendance all the time with a rifle in case he tried anything. And it's one day, he's really getting into it, breaking all these rocks, bang, 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 and breaking the rocks until he had a big pile of rocks, and the height of the rocks was bigger than him. And the guard was okay because he could hear him breaking the rocks. And even though the guard couldn't see him, he knew that he was always breaking the rocks and hear him bang, 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 bang. And then when he stopped breaking the rocks, the guard said, I must have been a bit tired, give him a couple of minutes. But then it was about 5 minutes and still couldn't hear him. So he went round the back of the pile of rocks, and he had been breaking rocks, but not the rocks in the pile he was supposed to break. He was breaking the rocks of the prison wall. And he got this big hole in the wall. And that's the whole point of getting really strong, you know, learning how to break rocks. And then when the pile was big enough, he was round the back, stopped breaking those rocks, and the limestone blocks of the prison wall. And he was never found. He escaped. So sometimes people like that, you know, I don't know, but it's so innovative. Let them escape. So anyway, if there's no will, no one, and nothing to improve, if you realize that, then you have escaped already. But you can say that, you can write that, you can expound that, but is that what's really happening? If you have, if there's no will, no one, nothing to improve, then you really are escaped. Please introduce the monk and the other three nuns sitting in front. Okay, that other monk over there, that's Metaji. I bring him along because he's English and he knows my jokes and he laughs at them. The other monks I bring here, they shake their head and go all over. And the other three nuns. Ah, would you like to introduce yourselves? Who's the next in line? Your name is? Sarata. And what is your background? You used to be on our Buddhist committee.
Short term?
Short term, yeah. And so that's what happens when you go on our committee and join up. You experience suffering and so you leave the world and become a... And who's the next in line?
Sailor.
And where are you from?
Newbury.
Where's Newbury? That's over in Melbourne. That's the monastery we are building over in Melbourne. Newbury Buddhist Monastery. And the next one?
Persana.
And where is Persana from? From Adelaide, from South Australia. Damasara now, yeah. But, so, we have nuns from all over. So that's why, yeah. So it's nice to have the nuns. And what we do, some time ago, we built the nuns' cottage. You know, just at the end of, after cottage number 5. And we did that because, you know, the Bhikkhuni Sangha is just beginning, and it's nice that they have the opportunity to actually to learn, you know, from the teachers who come and teach meditation here. And so we have that place available, and it's usually 2 bhikkhunis, 2 nuns from Dhammasara come at least, plus 2 other nuns, bhikkhunis, from outside Dhammasara, so that they means they can have enough contact together, learning meditation, and even learning how to teach, and getting to know one another. So that's our bhikkhuni's cottage, nun's cottage. So it's been a really successful, just having an opportunity that you can go on a retreat. So that's the monk and the other three nuns. And also, we have sitting next to Pasano, we have the teddy bears. And if you don't know what those teddy bears are there for, people say, where got all these teddy bears? Then please get a copy of the book, Bear Meditation. about where it is. I think it's the Indonesian edition is called Bare Meditation, not Bare Awareness. Because the different editions have different titles. So the bear is there to give you some kindness, some metta. Because sometimes when somebody asks, you know, I can't love myself, I give metta to so many other beings, but giving metta to myself is so difficult. How do I do loving kindness towards myself? And sometimes I say, well, get a dog or a cat or a rabbit or something. And it's much better than, as I say, getting a husband or a partner or a wife or something. They never speak back. So, and you get this and you just cuddle it. And it's non-threatening. It's soft. And it sometimes brings up just these feelings of kindness and softness. And you find if you cuddle a teddy bear when you're meditating, it's easier to be peaceful. When I keep saying this kindfulness, be aware and be kind, sometimes people don't know how to do that. So just sitting here with a teddy bear in your lap, it actually works. It enhances your meditation. So that's one of the reasons why it's good to adopt a teddy bear. You see a couple of people have got teddy bears. And why do you have those teddy bears? Does it work, Bali? Excellent. Does your teddy bear work, Becky? Very good. So when you have a teddy bear in your lap, if you haven't got deep meditation yet, you can try. If that doesn't work, we can have a bat. So, you know the power of Batman and Batwoman and Batmonk and Batnun. You know, this poor bat is a bit deformed. I think it needs a bit of TLC. You can always get a bat to cuddle. Yeah. Okay, what have we got here? When reading or hearing news of terrorism, environmental disasters, natural disasters, child abuse, etc., my meditation is affected, and I feel I should be doing something more to help. It is difficult to say to myself, none of my business when thoughts of these come up. How best to deal with them? And that sometimes that this is one of the best ways to help, by being a person of peace. And sometimes if there is terrorist attack, environmental, especially terrorism attack. Why do people do that? They do that to try and create disturbance in the world. And just learning how to be peaceful, to be still. There was a Q&A program on the ABC News. I never saw it, but people reported this to me. It's supposed to be valid. That when a panel of experts was discussing the how to deal with terrorism in the world, it was the editor of the Spectator magazine in London was actually visiting Australia, and when he took the question, he mentioned there had been a experiment done in Sussex University in UK. And it's not a sort of a crazy university. Sussex University is a university of high standing. And they said that they had done experiments, using all the controls and just getting as much information as possible, making sort of adjustments for is this causes or is it correlation? And they found that when they got enough students meditating, just around the campus, there was less incidence of crime and violence and abuse. Just somehow or other, the meditation calmed everybody down, just even in the area around, said the editor of the Spectator. So his solution to the problems in Iraq and Syria was to parachute in, not bombs or special service soldiers, to parachute in Buddhist monks and nuns who, just because of their peaceful demeanour and their meditation, would create peace in Syria or Iraq. And that's why I heard about it. And so at the time, being a bit of a scallywag monk, I started thinking of who would I like to send into Iraq. What monks and nuns could I volunteer to go there? But anyway, that we always have disasters which happen. Some are just physically caused by terrorism, some by natural disasters. And so how can we deal with that? Sometimes the best way of dealing with that is to create enlightened beings, peaceful, wise people, who don't add to the problem, but can actually solve the problem. Not even, you know, by going over there, but actually just by being peaceful people who can, by their very nature, create more peace in this world. So sometimes people running around, how terrible it is. Does that really help? So what can you do? And sometimes the power of stillness, the power of kindness. They always say that hatred never ceases by hatred, only by kindness, compassion, by love. Sounds good, doesn't it? But can you do that? So here, in this meditation retreat, we're enhancing our conflict resolution skills. If you can't even tolerate the person who bangs the door in your hut when they get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you can't tolerate those, then you need a lot of skills in conflict resolution and creating a peaceful place. Thanks for the advice last night. Now I am more relaxed, but seems I slept during meditation. How can I prevent this? Well, if you slept during meditation, why is it that people sleep during meditation? When they go back to their rooms, they can't go to sleep. So the answer is, when you come here to meditate, bring your pillow and try to sleep. And then you'll be perfectly awake. When you go back to your room, try to meditate. And then you'll fall fast asleep and have a good night's rest. So, it is all the trying stuff. So you relax, but seems I slept during meditation. Yeah, so if you slept during meditation, nothing wrong with that. So, what precepts do you break when you sleep during meditation? Pretty good, you know, no precepts at all, it's pretty good. That's why sometimes I tell people say, oh, just, so hard to keep precepts in today's world. And I say, well, what about your dog? How many precepts does a dog break? They don't drink alcohol, that's one precept they keep all the time. They don't lie. That's another precept they keep so easily. I don't know about the sexual misconduct stuff. Stealing, maybe not. But they don't usually kill things, dogs. They're pretty good that way. So it's these three precepts I think they keep all the time. That's much better than some human beings. So anyway, you know that dogs can sleep any time. They don't worry. Do dogs feel guilty about sleeping? I don't think so. So dogs are sometimes not that relaxed as you think, because that story, remember that story about the woman who came home and her hands were filled with shopping bags. She'd just been to do her weekly shopping, and when she opened the door of her house, you know, she's full of, hands full of shopping bags, so she just pushed the door open. And as soon as she pushed the door open, this dog ran past her and into her house. She didn't own the dog. It wasn't hers. But her hands were full of shopping bags, so couldn't stop the dog. So she went into the kitchen, just put all the bags down, and went to look where this strange dog had gone to. It was one of these, like, Labradors or Golden Retrievers or something. And I think Golden Retriever. And it was just curled up in the corner of the room, fast asleep. And it was just such a nice dog. And it wasn't her dog, I don't know where it came from, but it was just fast asleep, so she let it sleep. It was clean. And then 2 hours later, the dog woke up, and just gave a little nice soft bark, so she let it out, and the dog went out wagging its tail. It was really weird. But the next day, the same time, the dog came back. So he opened the door, it went into the nice corner of the room, and slept again for a couple of hours. And then barked and went out. And this happened for every day for a few days. And it was a really nice little dog, you know, it was really cute and just clean and didn't cause any trouble, just went to sleep in the corner of the house. So, in the end, the lady thought, I've got to find out where this dog comes from. So she had this bright idea, she got a little piece of paper and wrote on the piece of paper, this dog has been coming to my house every afternoon for the last 5 or 6 days. It's very welcome. It's a lovely dog. It's clean and well behaved. But I just want to know where it comes from and why it comes to my house. And so she wrote that, folded it up and put it in the dog's collar. And a few days, the next day, when the dog came back, it had a reply. And so the dog went to sleep in the corner and she read the note and said, this is my dog. We only live like, you know, just a block or two away. In my house, we have a wife who's always complaining. We have 5 or 6 kids, some only 3 or 4 years of age, always climbing over the dog and teasing the dog. And it's so noisy in my house. My dog comes over to your house for a bit of peace and quiet and a nice nap in the afternoon. That's why it's coming over to your house. P.S. Can I come over too? That's the stress of modern life. Even the dogs want to have some peace and quiet. Anyway, so that's sleeping during meditation. If you do need to sleep, then just the mind will sleep. And once the sleeping is done, and you feel good, then you find that you can meditate very easily, very wonderfully. Don't be afraid. And sometimes the sleepiness is cause and effect. In the jungles of Thailand, I was always sleepy in the morning, for years. And sometimes I'd really try hard, you know, put forth effort to really wake up. But very rarely you could actually break through your sloth and torpor. But then, I was restless. So I said, okay, calm the thoughts down. You're awake now, calm them down. You're fast asleep again. And for years I was using effort. But then what happened, I had to go down to Bangkok to renew my visa and do the visas for a few other monks as well. And Wat Bawan, one of the royal monasteries, we were allowed to stay there, and it had an air-conditioned meeting room, the first air-conditioned room I'd ever seen in a monastery, because the royal monastery was rich. And we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning in these other little dormitories without air conditioning, and we asked the monks, can we have the key to use this hall in the morning for meditation before alms round? They said, no one else was using it at that time. Yeah, sure. So we had the key and we would meditate there in the morning from about 3 till 5 and then get ready for the alms round and turn on the aircon. All my sloth and torpor had gone. It was easy to meditate. And obviously the reason was that the temperature had made me sleepy. And I thought afterwards, look, I was a monk made in England, not used to that hot temperature. And over there in Ajahn Chah's monastery, he told us only sleep 4 hours a day. And you know, I I would always get down to 4.5. I couldn't go any less, but not more than 4.5. I was sleep deprived. And if you see the food we ate, it was just totally non-nutritional. It was terrible food. Not just for taste, but just the proteins and stuff in it were just really absent. I was malnourished. I make up for it these days. But being malnourished, when you go to Bangkok, you know, you get some just nutritious food. And that's why I had energy. You know, you had no mosquitoes in those rooms, so you could sleep well and eat well. It was cool. There's no problem meditating. No sloth and torpor. And from that experience, I realized a lot of sloth and torpor is not a fault in you. It's just some cause and effect, conditions. It's nothing to do with you. If you don't get the right temperature, if you don't get good food, you don't get enough sleep, you're going to get tired. That's the nature of the body. So if you want to overcome sloth and torpor, now you get, you know, decent food, nutritious, which we have here. You get the right temperature. And if this is too cold for you or too hot for you, that's why try and meditate in your rooms. And just get enough sleep. And you find a lot of times people are sleep deprived. You know, people in our modern world, they don't get enough sleep because you're just too busy. I'm too busy sometimes and don't get enough sleep. But you just catch up on your sleep. It's only 2 or 3 days into this retreat. And afterwards, when you get back into your retreat, not too hot, not too cold, where you're meditating, then fine. You really get in some nice meditation. Not every meditation, but, you know, many meditations are very good because you're working with your body, understanding it. And sometimes I was talking to someone today. Sometimes you have your best times of meditation. Sometimes you may be a night person or an afternoon person or a morning person. And there are sometimes when you know that you feel really good, this is the time to meditate, so off you go and meditate. And if it's the case that the best time to meditate is just before lunch, and you think, oh, I'm going to miss my lunch. Now, Bianca is very kind. She knows that sometimes she saves you some food. Because, you know, you're meditating and you're not there in time for the lunch. So it's worthwhile not being afraid you're going to miss out on lunch. You'll have something. Because it's more important that when the mind is ready and the body is ready to have some meditation, you go for it. So sloth and torpor is not the biggest problem. Okay, yeah. Okay, this is something I'm not going to mention this about. I'll say this afterwards. Can we know why there are so many soft toys around? These aren't toys. These are meditation accessories. Dear Ajahn, suppose there are two meditators. The first one enters and remains in the first jhana for one whole day, while the second one enters and remains in the first jhana for 1 week. Is there any distinction of the purity of the mind between these two meditators after they come out from meditation? It's usually, if going for first jhana for 1 week, usually they go into deeper jhanas if they spend that much time there. But the purity of the mind afterwards, the 5 hindrances have been sort of suppressed, and the longer that they are suppressed, the longer you've been in jhanas, the more likely the longer those hindrances have been sort of knocked out. They will recover later on, but that does mean you're having a huge amount of happiness and joy and the ability, when those hindrances are knocked out, to see the Dhamma and to actually to really understand anicca, dukkha, anatta in a very deep way. Since it is Easter, may I ask if you believe in the historical Jesus? There's apparently evidence that he trained in meditation. Oh. In the historical Jesus, should I tell a couple of jokes about about the kid. The kid who was really, really a lazy boy. And especially, even though his father sort of taught it, gave him extra classes in maths and get tutors in maths, he could never do maths. And so in the end, the father spent a lot of money and enrolled him in a private school run by the Catholics. It's amazing. Just after even 1 week, his test scores in maths just went up. He started getting A's in all the maths tests. And so his father asked him, said, look, all the other things I tried to get into maths have never worked, but now you go to this Catholic school and everything goes really well. Why? You know, is it the quality of the teachers? No, the same quality of teachers. Is there more resources? No, the same resources. Well, what is it? And the kid said, well, as soon as I went into the lobby of that Catholic school and I saw this boy nailed onto the plus sign, I realized they were serious about maths in this school. Nailed onto the plus sign. Okay, that's a totally other thing about evidence that he trained in meditation. Yeah, there probably is. But anyway, I'll just go through these other ones first of all. Why my mind takes a long time to be peaceful? Can't it be faster? What rush are you in? If it's trying to be faster, that's why it's not peaceful. The fastest way is the slowest way. It's a patient way. So it takes a long time to be peaceful only because you're trying to make it peaceful. You're looking into the future. It takes a long time. How long does it take to be peaceful? Maybe we should do a test. We start the clock and see who's the fastest to become peaceful. It's not a question of time. If your mind is still has lots of thoughts about time, then it means that you haven't let go of past and future. You haven't really settled down in the present moment. So when one settles down in the present moment, then time has no meaning anymore. And then you find it's very easy to be peaceful. Could you please produce a book which Brahmification, the English translation of some Dhamma words, which do not serve justice, such as right stillness, right motivation? This will help English readers enormously. Your justification and clarification will help future Buddhist writers and scholars better translate these Pali words closer to its meaning and purpose. I've been doing that for years, but never get time to actually to get into it. That was my the retranslation of the word of the Buddha. So it is coming, but again, be patient. No rush. One day it'll be done. If you don't mind, and the general consensus is for it, would it be possible to do a nice, spooky, guided death meditation one of these evenings before the end of the retreat? I realize this would mean sacrificing one of the Q&A sessions I've been enjoying, and I hope it's not too cheeky of me to ask. Thanks with metta. So that's another spooky story. But the death meditations, that sometimes people get into it, sometimes people don't. Well, at least we know that everything sort of passes. But I'm not quite sure exactly why you want a death contemplation. Meditation. But anyway, let's think about that. Thank you for the Dhamma talk this morning. Can you please suggest how we restrain the five hindrances? It's by doing jhanas. Will developing the four Brahma viharas help? Yes, they help as well. And if you can find that out in the Nalakapana Sutta, where the 11 ways of becoming fully enlightened, for the four jhanas, the four arupa the three arupas and the four brahmaviharas. How do we develop upeka through meditation? Upeka is, sometimes people call it equanimity, but I sometimes, that just, it doesn't have an emotional feeling to it. I prefer like contentment. I know that word is given to like the word santuti, but the idea of contentment, you're fully content with what you have. This is good enough. Contentment to me is a far more positive word than equanimity. So imagine if we changed the word upeka as contentment. Deep, deep, deep contentment. You're totally happy to be here. Nothing missing. Not wanting anything more in the whole world. Just being here. Interesting possible translation. Regarding the ascetic practice in some monasteries, isn't that some hard practice necessary before the softer ones? As the yin and yang compete against each other, Buddha became enlightened because he had some austere practices before. Without that, maybe he wouldn't be able to discover that the jhanas are the good way. Isn't it in the human nature? This is the first thing the Buddha said. He said, don't do that. Now that's the first saying of the Buddha, teaching of the Buddha after he became enlightened. Don't practice that way. But still people like to be ascetic and austere. I don't know why they do that, some masochistic tendencies, thinking no pain, no gain. And we don't have that in Buddhism. We have anapanasati, mindfulness along with the breath. We never have anapanasati, mindfulness along with pain. And instead you look at these practices and it's joyful. And imagine a practice where of austerity. You get some people say, I'm more austere than you are. How long can you? Actually, at this Easter time now, there's still people apparently over in places like the Philippines who actually allow themselves to have nails driven through their hands and raised on crosses and whipping themselves, thinking that somehow or other through that, you know, they can emulate, you know, the story of Jesus and thereby just gain merit or gain some sort of liberation or somehow overcome bad karma. And to me that's just, you know, the word sick comes up. That's not the way to, but you know, people say, wow, you know, you're just really tough. Yeah, they're tough and they endure a lot, but is that really necessary? And so sometimes we say no. Instead we have this beautiful, they had even in the early times, there was, oh, what was his name? It was Anthony, I think. But he actually, he climbed one of these old, these pillars. He used to hold up the roof of a temple. And they had lots of these ruins over in that part of the world in Greece. And just, he would climb up the top and he would live up there, you know, for years. And he had a little basket, they'd take food up with him. He was exposed to the elements all, you know, throughout the year. And just apparently that, you know, he had his belt, because he'd never take it off or wash it, and so had maggots would fall off. You know, it was just eating his skin all the time. And this was supposed to be just like a saint. And I mean, I remember when I read about this the first time, the person who described this had a sense of humour. He said, because people would actually go up there and ask for blessings and ask for advice. It's like they ask for advice from me after lunch. That's why sort of it's really hard to get back here in time. Ask for advice and just counselling and stuff. And so it was the original agony column. I see you got that. That's why I invite him here. I think you can laugh at us. So yeah, very good. But anyway, they used to do that and people get really respect them. You know, just because of how austere they were. And so sometimes Does that ever give rise to peace, to wisdom? I've never seen cases where it does. So, in some monasteries, isn't it some practice necessary before the softer ones? I saw many good monks that would not be able to take such harsh practices, and they left. And sometimes those harsh practices, you know, just really injured their minds. And so this is just too much, it's too severe. And so, you know, from my experience, you know, you wouldn't believe this, but I was quite tough. I could do all sorts of austere practices. But you realized after a while, you see it in other ones, it never made them get, you know, anything which was really of great use. And so, I don't really believe that those hard practices, sometimes the monks would do these like watching autopsies. And, you know, even when I was a kid, they used to have on the BBC TV 5 minutes of, like, your body, and they had operations on the TV. And my family is in black and white. My mother, father, and brother would leave the room, and I would watch it. And I said, it's educational. And that argument always won with my parents. But I didn't mind at all, seeing dead bodies and stuff. And even later on, when you went to see autopsies, in Thailand you could see autopsies. As a monk, you could just walk straight in. I remember the autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital. And this was, you know, not a joke. I went there early, and they had like an lecture theatre. They had the slab in front, no bodies on it yet. But then I went up by the window, and it looked like where you'd usually expect a flower pot, it looked like there was a human head there. So I went actually up to it, and it wasn't like a fake one, it was a real one. They had like a human head on a plate in the autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital. I lifted it up, and this is real. I never found out why they put it in there. But, you know, that was really weird stuff. And because, you know, it's something we sometimes do in order to actually to understand the nature of the body and just to, you know, have some detachment for it. So it's one of those contemplations which monks and nuns are supposed to do. So I remember the story that's over in Bante Ji's monastery, Gunaratna's monastery in West Virginia, that he was talking about they used to go and see autopsies. So a few of his disciples went to the local hospital and tried to get into the autopsy room. And they said, no, you can't go in there. You're not medical students. You've got no authorization. And so that... they kept on asking, well, this is, you know, it's what we're supposed to do in our religion. You know, it's actually just to see the nature of a human body so we can contemplate it, so we can detach from it. And they said no, they kept on saying no. One by one, the students gave in. There was only one student left there. And he tried, well, he saw this autopsy worker coming out, and he said, look, you know, I really want to come, you know, inside and watch an autopsy. It's only one of me. It's just for my spiritual development. Can I come? He said, look, I can't. I'm only a worker in here, and I'm just too busy. I'm going through a divorce. And I'm too busy for this sort of stuff. And the fellow, the student of Bante Ji, Gunaratna, he said, actually, I'm a lawyer. I can help you with the paperwork in return for you letting me in to the autopsy room. And, you know, the worker there said, why not? No one will know. And, you know, getting a lawyer to do divorce papers is really expensive. So they went to the room and he did all the divorce papers properly, you know, for the worker. And then afterwards, the worker got, you know, a little suit for him, you know, the worker suits, and got him through into the autopsy room. And the doctors, he wrote this article, which was very funny. He said the doctors were doing an autopsy on this African man who had so many things wrong with him. They called him a piece of work. They had to find out why he had died, what the cause of death was. And so they were cutting up this and cutting up that. And this was, you know, not a doctor, not authorized to be there. He was actually a lawyer, disciple of Bhante Gunaratana. He was really fascinated by this investigation. What was the cause of death? And then one of the doctors, this female doctor, there it is. That's the cause of death. And had this Latin word. And this doctor, sorry, this lawyer, you know, not being able to keep his mouth shut, said, oh, it's a cancer. And everybody went quiet. And they looked at him. Because the Latin word did not mean cancer. It was the Latin word for medical malpractice. And they said, who are you? He said, oh, I'm a lawyer. And they said, get out of here now. So that's why sometimes they don't allow even Buddhists. There's too many lawyers in our Buddhist community. And they don't want to be found out. But anyway, so some of those, when you go to even to autopsies, you know, some of them, death contemplations, some of them, do they really work? Not really. It gives away a little bit of the... Because we compartmentalize. I remember we asked the coroner in Perth once. He said, you cut up bodies every day. And we just asked him, sort of, frankly, this is not sort of criticizing or just being too personal, but, you know, when you go home to your wife, you know, how do you regard her body? And she said, no, just like I compartmentalize. The bodies on the slab, which I have to cut open to find out the cause of death, you know, they're not alive, they're sort of different. But, you know, a live body is sometimes much, much different to me. So, even the contemplating of sort of dead bodies, spooky death contemplation, sometimes it doesn't really work because we do compartmentalize. A live body and a dead body are different to us. So anyway, that's why that sometimes doing those death contemplations sometimes doesn't really work. It does maybe for some, but I've never seen it being that effective. Okay, now you want a super scary ghost story, please. Or the historical Jesus. Is there evidence he trained in meditation? Shall we do that first? Or spooky ghost story? Sorry?
Jesus.
Not spooky. Okay, well, actually, the spooky ghost story, I think the person who asked this has heard this before, but it is the spookiest, because it is real. And that was the one, again, in the same hospital where I saw the head, just, you know, on the windowsill, real head. Because these were the main hospital in Bangkok. And this was the one about the ghost. Oh, I shouldn't say where it was. But there was a doctor who was finishing his night shift. And he was going down in the elevator, in the lift, to the basement where his car was parked so he could drive home. And there was a nurse with him in the elevator, a witness. And the elevator stopped halfway down. And as it stopped halfway down, there was a patient trying to get in the lift as the doors opened. There was a patient on the outside. And the doctor freaked out. And he pushed closed the door button as fast as he possibly could. And he managed to close the doors of the elevator before the patient could enter. And that really upset the nurse. What are you doing that for? There was a patient wanting to get into the lift. You know, he has a right to be in the lift as well. Why do you keep him out? And that was when the doctor said, that was one of my patients. who died last night. That wasn't a real patient trying to get in the elevator. That was a ghost. And in Thailand, when somebody died, they put red string on their wrist. Not the white string, but red colour. And so, didn't you see the red string on my patient's wrist? They were dead. And the nurse replied, oh, I never saw that red string. And the nurse raised her hand, I've got a red string too. Does that mean I can't go in the lift? And that was what the doctor said when they resuscitated him. He had actually fainted in the lift, and they found this unconscious doctor on the floor of the lift. And when they resuscitated him, they asked him, what happened? And that's the story he told. And they checked that nurse. She died on the way to the hospital in the morning traffic. I had a ghost inside and one outside. That's a pretty dangerous situation to be in. Now that's an old spooky ghost story. But of course, because I do lots of funeral services, that once we were doing a burial for a Chinese person who lived in Perth. And on this burial, the Chinese plots, I think this was at Fremantle Cemetery, the place where they buried the Chinese was way down the furthest part of the cemetery. So, I knew it was a long walk. And to pass the time, I was in front of the hearse with the funeral director. So I just started a conversation. I said, how long have you been in this industry? And she said, oh, just about 20, 30 years. This is my last year. I'm going to retire. I said, oh, great. You must have some really good ghost stories. Oh, yeah, yeah. And said, have you seen ghosts? And he said, oh, yeah. The first one is like funny, because she said that she sees ghosts all the time in the office. Because they put the bodies, and no, she has to make sure they're properly embalmed, in a box and put them in the freezer. They're stored in the funeral parlour. And she says sometimes, especially, I don't know why it's late at night, she's doing the paperwork late at night, and the door of the office is open, and she sees the dead people walking past. She recognises them, because she knows they're in the box, in the coffin. You know what she says to them? She told me, when I see them, I'm not scared, because I'm used to this. I just scold them. Hey, you, get back in your box. That's what she said to me. But I said, what's the spookiest thing? And she told me something which I never knew. So when they have the hearse, which they put the coffin in, sometimes there's maybe 3 or 4 burials a day. And so when they put the box in the hearse, it has to be spotlessly clean. So it's clean before they take it to the crematorium or cemetery, and it's clean again when it comes back, ready for the next ceremony. And that hearse is cleaned every day, maybe 3 or 4 times. And they hire one person whose only job it is to clean that hearse. And he said, this gentleman was cleaning the hearse inside after one cremation or funeral or burial, cleaned it up, and then just locked it as it started cleaning the outside. And inside that hearse, he'd already cleaned it spotlessly, but no, closed the doors, locked it, as he started to clean the outside. And the hearse, the windows, started to mist up for no reason. a mist came on all of the windows of the hearse. And that was really weird. But what happened next was really spooky. Handprints appeared on the misty windows from the inside. Handprints. There was no one inside. Maybe. But whatever it was, something inside was trying to get out. Was that spooky enough? But actually, the real ghost stories are really, really nice. The spooky ones, they don't harm anybody. They're usually very, very good. And the historical Jesus is... the historical Jesus, this was the story of the burglar. The burglar was, came into a house late at night, crept in, thought no one was at home, and he heard somebody say, what was it? God and Jesus are watching you. What was it? Was it God and Jesus? I think it was, Jesus is watching you. Okay. They heard the voice say, Jesus is watching you. And he said, this is really weird. There's no one in the house. So Jesus is watching you. And so he used his flashlight and found out where the sound was coming from. And it was just a parrot. Oh, it's only a parrot, said the thief. And the parrot replied, my name's not Jesus. Jesus is our Rottweiler. Jesus is watching you. Or the joke went something like that. I'm getting tired. Okay. Is that scary enough? Okay, scary enough. Okay. There was another sort of question, but I really don't want to mention that tonight because I don't think it will be of any help at the moment. So anyway, that's 9:24, so I think it's time enough to call it a night. Fortunately, there's no elevators here. So you are safe when you... Yeah. Okay, so... Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. If the person who asks the unanswered question, if they, we'll probably do what you ask for at the end of the retreat, because I don't want to disturb the peace of the retreat at this time. That wasn't the historical Jesus, that was just the dog. Mm-hmm.